Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Mark Mueller Eberstein, best-selling author. Mark has a new book, No Fear, Business Leadership in the Age of Digital Cowboys. Mark is also a top-ranking CEO, COO, speaker, mentor, coach, and strategist. Now, Mark, thank you for coming in today. You know, you have such a remarkable career in so many areas of considerable success in so many domains, and it's great that you're able to find the time to share this expertise, insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Stephen, thank you very much for inviting me today again. Talking with you and being able to address your audience is it's a big honor. I'm really excited to be here today and looking very much forward to our discussion. I mean, a lot of has happened since our last discussion after my book, Agility, Competing and Winning in the Tech Savvy Marketplace, came out. And that discussion and our interview and the listeners to the interview sparked a lot of great follow-on conversations and unlocked some synergies for them as well as for us and me personally. So I'm really looking forward to the interview today and the follow-up questions and comments from your audience as well. It is always great to work with communities like yours and ours here and to learn from each other's success. So we are really looking forward to this one as a starting point, the book as another milestone, and then continued an ongoing discussion and sharing of information.
Mark, you expressed an interest in the IFIP World CIO Forum, or WCF. Now, why should CIOs, senior executives, government, industry, and academic leaders participate in the World CIO Forum?
I think the World CIO Forum is a great opportunity. I think what you've seen with events like the World Economic Forums, you have the opportunity to bring people together that are passionate around change, around enabling change, driving leadership, and embracing new thoughts, new ideas, and of course, new technologies. The summit in November, I'm very, very excited to be there, to be able to share some more of the thoughts here, and very, very excited to engage with the other participants, both the CIOs, the business leaders, as well as the thought leaders from academic and consulting environments to really share some ideas. As you know, my personal topics and focus areas around embracing and leveraging of consumerization of IT for business success is one of those things I'm thinking about nearly on a day-to-day basis. Events like the CIO Forum are directly in line with what we and my team are trying to do is reducing the ambiguity of challenge, really explaining what is happening, developing actionable plans, connecting people. And the CIO Forum is a great way of utilizing the existing network, connecting with people that might not have seen for a while, and building new relationships, both between myself and them, but also introducing people to make new connections between them, leveraging synergies, sharing ideas, and eventually developing an impact that is changing organizational cultures, leadership, technology adoption, and makes the individuals that are participating, the organizations they are representing, and societies in large more successful and more prepared for the changes that are coming and turn those changes into opportunities.
So, Mark, how do you feel the WCF, or World CIO Forum, will take its participants, IT executives, and the industry in general to the next level?
Based on what I've seen so far and the information that has been shared with me about the event itself and preparation for the agenda, making sure that the right topics are covered, I was very impressed with the caliber of people that are already committed, the topics that are covered, and it's directly in line with some of the key areas that I hear on a day-to-day basis on top of business leaders and IT leaders' minds. How can I leverage IT for my business success? How can I reduce ambiguity in a changing world? What are the right ways of getting IT capabilities to my organizations? What is the cloud doing? Is it a private cloud? What are the impacts of a private cloud as an alternative to traditional implementations? What is the impact of the public cloud, not only for my organization, but for society at all? Are we going in a way where we're dependent, like we are dependent on electricity, for maybe one or two vendors? How do we deal with this as a society and as an organization? I think it goes beyond purely IT. It really looks at the broader impact of organizational changes, of the change in organizational values, and it brings together representatives from a vast variety of backgrounds. I think that's the key, what I've seen in my work over the years, is as more different and diverse perspectives you bring together, as more viewpoints you're incorporating, as more knowledge you can generate, and more effective networks and results you can generate. So I'm really looking forward to engaging there with the participants, with the other speakers, with you and the team, of course, and can't wait to meet a lot of the listeners of the program today at the event in November.
Mark, let's now talk about your current roles, your prior book, and then this current book that you just released. So first of all, can you overview some prior roles and leadership lessons you wish to share?
Absolutely, yes. I think the last time Stephen and I you talked, we looked a little bit more on my history at Microsoft and Hewlett-Packard and some of the other business ventures I had the opportunity to participate and build. What I would like to do is, in introduction to the discussion about the new book, No Fear, Business Leadership in the Age of Digital Cowboys, sharing two experiences that are directly related to that shift in what is required from business leaders going forward. That in hindsight, I think very clearly defines that, yeah, this is different. There's a lot of opportunity there. And how can we make sure we actually describe it, we leverage it, and we share it for as many people to enable them and their organizations for success as well. So one of the examples that came to mind, and of course we have lots and lots now on a day-to-day base here within EdgeTech's consulting business, is actually from my prior career at Microsoft. My team was responsible for a variety of topics. One of them were pre-release programs, and those are traditionally called beta programs, to A, get information out there, but also get some technical feedback, challenges, and validation out before the product is actually final. Such beta projects at Microsoft are usually a huge, huge effort, making sure that all the marketing and the technology and development support readiness areas are matched and are driven. What was different this time was that I actually got relatively late put in charge of that particular project, and there were really no full-time employees that are focusing on that particular challenge. I was able to do is putting a hat on which I today would describe as being a producer, understanding exactly what the beta experience for all these different stakeholders, both inside the company and, of course, for the millions of customers out there, should be and would be. What are the insights we need to generate? How can we ensure there is a good experience for all of them? And then I put a team together that was purely temporary. So I was able to leverage resources from a variety of different companies, different strengths, making sure we complemented each other well, provided them with the access to the information and the information holders, stakeholders, workstream owners of a vast variety of other organizations, and then pulled all of this together and launched Microsoft's largest beta ever. We had over 9 million downloads. That's compared to the previous version, Office 2007. We had 2 million downloads. Again, with Office 2010, that project, we had over 9 million downloads. We had not only one product, under the Office umbrella, we launched 36 different products with a variety of different functionalities, target audiences that needed to be made available, distributed, tracked. All of these things needed to come together, and we had by far the most successful beta of Microsoft ever. And of course, after we were done, we documented all of those findings, and then the individual team members all moved on. So learnings are there for the next time, but the team itself was really pulled together on a temporary base. And what it took for success is a very different kind of leadership. It's making sure you select for a specific area, for a specific team, a skill set, and being available with guidance where necessary, but also making sure that the people are empowered to actually drive the key results there. Another example is just out of my very recent out of my very recent projects here at EdgeTech. One of the areas we looked into is the value, again, teams or access to information can provide to make an end result far more impactful for a client when we connect the right information and the right approach. In that particular case, I got contacted by one of my clients who needed to have a specific research question around some of their customer groups answered. And they had gone out to get quotes from traditional research companies first and said, okay, this is what we're trying to understand. Can you do that for us? And some said no, some said yes, but the quotes they received were very, very high and far above the budget they could have originally they were willing to spend on this particular area, they were able to spend on this particular question. So we talked, and by really bringing into the discussion experts that were familiar with the customer situation, with other data sources that are already available both inside the company as well as outside the company, we were able to actually develop a research plan that would not only answer the question of the client, but actually provide insights that would go far beyond and make the original question, the answer to the original question, far more actionable and directly, quickly actionable for the organization. And because we were able to leverage all this existing information, the total cost of the project were only a fraction of what they had been quoted earlier. Of course, eventually we needed to outsource some of this work to a research company that did some of the research. But that was far, the overall project still was far cheaper, and the result was going far beyond the original plan. The key there was really, again, bringing the right people together that knew where information was, that knew what the business looked like, what the key concerns were, and allowing them to connect and to work with their network to drive the best plan and the best execution for the client. In our book, we call the most connected and the most energetic drivers, we call them the digital cowboys. A digital cowboy is extremely well connected and very used to working in a decentralized environment. They're used to making decisions, and they want to make decisions. They're driving, if they decide they own something, if they are signing up to it, they are going to deliver, and they will utilize the resources, find within their network, within their information environments, to do what it takes to deliver the results they have committed to drive. We call them digital cowboys, thinking about the cowboys of the old Wild West, where to get a herd of cattle over the Western prairie, people needed to work together. They had different traits, they had different backgrounds, often from very different cultures, very different, sometimes languages, but they all worked together for the common goal and had established a way of communication that made the overall team successful. And we see the same attitude now more and more on the workplace, especially while the young people, we call them Gen Y, or we call them the PlayStation generation, usually born after 1985, people that grew up with the internet, that grew up with mobile communication and don't know a time when it was different. And they bring this, not only those tools, but really the experience they have built using those tools, using their network, using communities. They bring this to the workplace and have there the opportunity to provide tremendous increases in productivity, tremendous increases in business success overall for the organization.
Now, Mark, you know, we've talked about this just fantastic book that you've written. Now, can you profile your last book, Key Tips from the Book, and the success of this book?
Absolutely, Stephen. I think last time we talked, my first book as an author, my Agility Competing in the Tech-Savvy Marketplaces was just coming out, which was for me a very new experience. As a business leader for many, many, many years, I had never written a book before. Of course, I've written white papers, articles, but this was the first time for me. I actually went through the process of putting all these thoughts down, mostly because a lot of people I've worked with on a day-to-day basis asked me to do so. So when Agility, Competing and Winning in a Tech-Savvy Marketplace was published by Wiley in August of 2010, I didn't really know what to expect. And I was very positively surprised. Just for the listeners who are coming, who haven't heard about it yet, you can check it out, of course. It's available everywhere in every good bookstore, Amazon and so on, of course, too. Agility is based on the opportunity we had to look at IT data, IT capability data for over 15,000 different organizations and analyze it together with universities like MIT and Boston University. Four interesting insights, especially insights that would provide a direct business impact for those organizations. And what we found is, yes, absolutely, IT does matter. It matters to making sure that organizations stay competitive and get a competitive advantage. We documented what does this mean for different industries. We documented clearly how leaders can derive the insights for their own organizations and their own markets and competitive landscape. And then, at least as important, what I'm hearing from my readers is we provide the guidance of how to drive the change, how to prioritize, how to initiate the change, and how to facilitate the discussion between the IT organization as part of the overall business success. So it helped really facilitate the discussion between the leaders of facilities, of HR, of finance, of marketing, of the sales organization, and have a far more effective discussion with the IT leaders in defining what's necessary to drive things forward. I think one of the most interesting quotes I've heard was, "You should not buy, for one of the IT audiences said, you should not buy only one book of Agility. You should buy one for yourself and then one for all the people you're working with on a day-to-day basis." So that was really nice to hear, and it actually translated into a market success that we originally really didn't plan for when we were pulling this book together. It made it on the Amazon bestseller list for MIS, the Management of Information System. It actually made it on that bestseller list. What personally really was very gratifying is the feedback from the readers themselves. First, of course, through the website, MüllerEberstein.com, where people can engage directly with me. But also, of course, on Amazon, people have the opportunity to provide reviews, and we got a lot of 5-star reviews there, comments, very thoughtful comments that I appreciated. And Amazon ranked Agility, Competing and Winning in the Tech-Savvy Marketplace actually as the top 20 book for business decision makers. So clear recommendation there from the readers, as well as from the leading bookseller worldwide, Amazon, there. Another interesting insight is the format people actually buy and read books. We probably have all heard that that the electronic versions are definitely increasing on volume, and I can definitely say that for Agility as well. So a lot of the readers are from the IT environment, and they are thought leaders, and I can tell you why they still like a good hard copy book, and it's much easier to sign a hard copy book over a Kindle. A lot of people buy the electronic version of the book. It's easy, they get it immediately, and can just start reading and acting on it. So, interesting side note there.
Congratulations on just the tremendous success that you had with the first book, and again, a great foundation for your next book. So, and let's kind of focus on that book. Now, what led you to write your current book and the reasons behind its title?
Yes, Stephen, thank you. I think success of Agility, Competing and Winning in a Tech-Savvy Marketplace was really the tremendous feedback and the compliments I received from IT leaders and their business counterparts over the months after the book came out. Of course, after my first book, I said, I'm not sure if I'm going to do that again. It was an exhausting experience, but soon after getting this positive feedback, how important it was to document these ideas and share them, I started to think about the next project. Of course, in my day-to-day interactions, I'm focusing a lot on cloud computing, what cloud computing, private cloud, public cloud, and the capabilities it provides can add to organizations and how they can be leveraged by organizations, both the pros, cons, challenges, and how to deal with them. As well as with the big movement we are seeing that we call the consumerization of IT. A lot of people have their devices in their private lives and they bring them more and more into the office. So both of those two trends were things I was focusing on, I was discussing and speaking on. When I got introduced by one of the CEOs I was working with to a gentleman who became then my co-author, Pekka Viljakainen. Pekka is an executive from Finland, self-made entrepreneur, very successful over the years in the Scandinavian and the Scandinavian, Baltic, European, up to in Russia area. And Pekka was at the fall of last year, he was in the process of taking a sabbatical. And similar to my experience where our counterparts and the people we're working with had asked us to document all the things we're talking about, he had the same experience and was in the process of defining how to write a book and what it should be exactly about. So we got introduced by this CEO we both know and talked very, very early on about the concept itself, things that we see the industries and our and the people we're interacting with are really on what's on top of their mind, and found the combination of looking at management, looking at generational shifts, looking at technology, the company culture shift, all of these so interesting that we spent a lot of time utilizing Skype. He from his cabin in Finland and I'm sitting here north of Seattle. Really sketched this out and said, yeah, there's definitely something we can do together. And as more we talked, as more the ideas crystallized behind it. So Pekka came out to Seattle. We finalized the concept and then I started to actually produce the book by making sure we have the right team in place, we have the right resources in place. Both of us, both Pekka and I, looked at our network to ensure that it's not only our ideas, but we have the opportunity to really get them challenged and validated by other people that we highly respect, whose opinion we respect, and reached out to them. And we were very, very fortunate to have a lot of very, very strong people contributing to the book itself. And then it's going beyond the book. We are going to, as a community, we are establishing where the discussion beyond the book is ongoing as well. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit later. But now back to your question, why no fear and business leadership in the age of digital cowboys? So no fear, we find very fitting, because we think a lot of change is going on. People in all levels are facing this change. And change is nearly always unsettling nearly for everybody. And the question, though, is then how to deal with change. So we wanted to make sure, and often fear of the unknown, fear of change gets in the way of embracing the opportunities that change can bring. And because the change that is happening now and is going to happen over the next decade is so fundamental, we wanted to make sure we address the challenges that are in the way, which is fear of people that can influence it, that can drive it, that can make decisions, that we address that head on and making sure we are helping people to understand what's happening, understand how they can react, how they could react, how other people are reacting, and how they can then overcome the fear, not being fearless and foolish, but really overcome consciously the fears they are identifying and turning them into action and leveraging the opportunities. The second part of the title, the business leadership in the age of digital cowboys, is helping the reader to understand what the book is about. It is not only about IT. Of course, as I'm from my background, there's a strong focus on that topic as well. But it's really about managing an organization. It's written from the viewpoint of executives. It is the contributors are usually either CEOs or CIOs of large organizations, or academics that are working with that environment on a very regular basis, on a day, or nearly day-to-day basis. So it helps the current business leaders, but also the people that want to be business leaders in the future to understand how to address fears, how to overcome them, and how to turn them into opportunity, and also how to develop the next generation of leaders. I think one of the interesting facts that we have seen, especially over the last, I would say, 6 months with the developments in the Arab world, is that there is a new generation coming into the world, into the society, and into the workplace that has a fundamental different understanding of collaboration and transparency than the generations before, and they are far better connected. I think it's interesting that in the Arab countries, 60% of people are under 30 years old today. In China, it's even 70%. So for organizations that want to be successful in those emerging markets, it is very important that they build local organizations that, of course, will have leaders that are coming from the local environment. But those people will be much younger in leadership positions than we have seen in the decades before. And those younger people, with their different attitudes, with their different approaches, will bring a change not only to the organizations they are going to lead, but also to the organizations across the world that are acting internationally and want to be successful there. And we call the most connected, the key drivers, the future leaders out of that generation, we call them the digital cowboys, based on a concept from Professor Maloney, where he describes the cowboys as key people making things happen, driving things, being flexible. And we see them as a model for not only the latest generation, but also for people that are a little bit older than 30, and how to interact, how to collaborate, and how to lead organizations in the future.
So that's a sort of excellent kind of background of sort of how the book came about. And you talked about your co-author. Now let's kind of drill into that a little bit further. Now, why write this book with your co-author, Pekka Viljakainen?
Said Pekka Viljakainen and I didn't know each other 12 months ago, but that's one of those nice things about being an author, running a business. You get to learn, you get to meet far more new people than was possible before. And those discussions are very often invigorating. Pekka, again, was in a place in his life where he wanted to share his thoughts. And I was thinking about getting my next book project that is dealing with the IT concepts of consumerization and cloud computing out to my audience. And we realized that there's definitely a very clear alignment on how we think, what this means for organizations and for the cultures of organization. And we could share a lot of the experiences. So it was, and then just on a personal level, Pekka and I got along very well in our discussions and our meetings. We said, yep, we can definitely make this happen. We are both results-oriented. We both have the same understanding of what we would like to tell, the stories we want to tell. And it was just a natural fit and really a pleasure and fun to do this together.
So what is Pekka doing right now?
So Pekka is right now, after we finished the manuscript, so we actually just handed it off to the printing press. I just heard that the Finnish version is already printed. The Russian version is in print right now. The English version is getting to the printers, I think, today or tomorrow. So he is taking a deep breath, and doing what he did over the last years, which is sponsoring a chamber musical festival out in Helsinki. And then he is thinking about what his next big step is. And there's an interview with Pekka on the community site where he is talking about this topic as well. What are his next steps? And he made it very clear that while it was a lot of fun writing the book and sharing those ideas in this writing format, he definitely sees himself primarily as a business executive, and that's what he's going to continue to do for the next 30 years of his career.
Now, can you describe the format of the book and the target audience for the book?
Sure. When we originally started, we were looking for somewhere around 200 pages, but as more and more discussion we had and as more interesting feedback and insights we were getting from our friends and co-contributors, we realized that to cover the topic of this next generation and the change that it's going to bring to management and to organizations will take a little bit more. So the final book ended up at around 300 pages, and the people who have seen the nearly final draft think it's still very well readable, because it's written on a very personal tone. It captures a lot of Pekka's and some of my stories in an interesting way. People liked it, and I think it's an easy read that though still provides a lot of insight and dedicated insight there. The focus audience are really business leaders of all levels that are thinking about the future of their organization. They're thinking about how to expand, how to maintain their own business, but also to expand it both domestically as well as internationally, how to leverage a very changing labor market. I think it's interesting to see that a year ago we were still talking about the recession, and now we are already at a point where in many European countries we basically have the lowest unemployment rates for the last 25 years already. I think in the U.S. We're still a little bit behind here, but I've seen an interesting statistic that says out of college-educated people, the rates are dropping very quickly as well. So there's a lot of movement there that will impact how the workforce is pulled together. And we are also seeing a shift in the traditional employment models where people, of course, the times where people started one company and stayed there for 40 years, those times are nearly everywhere over. It's really getting teams together when they are needed and often for a much, much shorter time than traditional employment would look like. And it requires a very different kind of leader to be successful in that environment, both in the traditional Western countries, but definitely also and even more in countries where the demographics are far more representing the younger generation.
Now, you know, there's a lot of books out there and there's a lot of noise. So how do you cut through the noise? Like, why would readers find relevance in the book?
I think it is because it is really built on the personal experiences of two people that are living in that environment on a day-to-day basis, and they're not only talking the talk, but they are walking the talk for the last 15 years and today, and determined to do that tomorrow. The opportunity to hear from people that you usually wouldn't be able to read from. I think by utilizing our network, being able to tap into the thought leadership of business leaders from Russia to China, Europe and California, we have a very, very unique perspective directly from the front line of leadership that usually you cannot find in any other publication I've seen so far. It goes, the idea, the thoughts, and the concepts are definitely relevant to leaders of today and the people who want to be leaders of tomorrow. That's what we are hearing. And we're seeing the excitement around this project building more and more. So the book itself is the starting point, but we move beyond that. We have created a community online. It's called www.nofearcommunity.com, where we're building on top of the book. So the book will come out in English in about July, the July timeframe. The community is already out there. We have blog posts that go beyond the book itself. They're drilling down in some areas. We have from, of course, the authors, but also from, I just saw the draft that will go up in the next few days by another CEO from the Scandinavian environment and key drivers of the economic collaboration for the Baltic Germany and Russia, driving that to the next level in those collaborations. So there's very, very interesting people that are starting to participate and contribute their thoughts, and they're all committed on the No Fear community to really drive this as a idea exchange place. So we, both Pekka and I, started this and our contributors feel the same. We are very excited about mentoring. We're excited about sharing ideas and also being mentored, of course, being mentees and learners as well. And No Fear, we think the No Fear community will provide the platform for an open exchange of ideas, open exchange of questions, and connection with people that are having similar challenges and either already have figured it out or we figured it out together. The initial feedback we got on No Fear, Business Leadership in the Age of Digital Cowboys has been really phenomenal. We are expecting to launch the book in three languages. And even pre-release, the publisher, Marshall Cavendish, discussed the concept and a very, very early draft of the book with their publishing colleagues from other countries at the London Book Fair about 6 weeks ago. And based on that preliminary information, we now have five more languages and countries that will be publishing the book. So it will be available before the end of the year. In addition to English, Finnish, and Russian, it will be available in German by Wiley Germany. It will be available in Chinese, in Hindi, in Swedish. Sure, I'm forgetting one right now, but come back to me in a second. So very broad coverage, and I'm expecting that will only grow. We started to see some press articles out in the environment. I think, again, Pekka is a big name in Scandinavia. We had, just after his interview with one of the Swedish management magazines, we had 15,000 hits on the community itself. So there's definitely a huge interest in the topic itself and an interesting discussion that is starting there.
Now, you invited global leaders to participate in the book. Why did you do this, and who are the leaders, and what lessons do they provide?
Yeah, I think that's one of the really, really fortunate things for us, and we're very, very thankful for the opportunity to engage with so many people across the world and look at their different perspectives. For the book No Fear, we have had the opportunity to work with people that are really outstanding thinkers and leaders in their specific environment, and made the time available to personally sit down, writing their thoughts on a specific topic down, making sure it is printable, of course, and sharing and being able to share their thoughts in this format. We have eight, we call them our friends and contributing authors, from a vast variety of geographies as well as backgrounds, but they all have in common they are true leaders in the new world. They are true leaders that are influencing their direct environment, but a far, far larger ecosystem in itself as well. So we have, just to get through the names of people that are contributing in a quick way, which of course doesn't do them justice, we have Mr. Arkady Dvorkovich, who is the chief advisor of the Russian president, and he's writing on the Russian politics and insights and developments, both on an educational level as well as on a government environmental level for businesses. We have Viktor Orlovsky, who is the CIO of the largest Russian bank, the Sberbank, and talking about his own experiences with technology, the consumerization of technology, and challenges a conservative, very, very conservative industry like the banking industry is facing through the changes that are happening right now, but also outlining the opportunities organizations like banks, but of course other organizations as well, have by leveraging this upcoming change. We have academics like Bill Fischer, from IMD Lausanne in Switzerland and China, who is one of the key thought leaders on management and management culture, organizational culture, and what it means for leaders to be successful. We have CEOs like Martin Mikos, who is the CEO of Eucalyptus Systems in California and the former CEO of MySQL. We have the CEO of Parallels, Birger Steen, and former president of Microsoft Russia, who was sharing his personal story of leading an army of digital cowboys, of building a subsidiary in an emerging country for one of the large Western companies and the challenges of culture that he had to face and what he learned out of it, and he's sharing that in detail. We have Philip Rosenthal, who is a top technology evangelist out of Germany and advisor to senior executives across the world. A good friend of Pekka, Kari Hakola, who is the former senior vice president of Tietoevry and management consultant today. Very, very experienced person on building organizations, and I would say partner in crime with Pekka of developing the original leadership development program within Tietro, with it's one of the largest system integrators in Scandinavia and in Europe, out of Scandinavia. And last but not least, we were able to win Alex Lin, who is the founder and CEO of China Value, an internet company out of Beijing, China, it's like the Chinese version of LinkedIn, but goes beyond it because it's really fostering there as well the mentoring, the idea sharing, and the collaboration aspects, which really impresses me with my passion for mentoring, of course. And he shares his insights on the Chinese market, but also, again, on how to engage with the younger generation. What does this mean for companies that are moving in that direction? So really, really thankful for all of their contributions, and I think it makes the book much richer, a much richer experience than just Pekka and me talking about our thoughts. I think having this opportunity to validate, to get them the ideas, get them challenged, and having then the personal stories and insights contributed by those people makes a huge, huge difference. And usually you don't get to read the insights of CEOs or aides of the president in a book format or any other format. So this is definitely a very unique opportunity for the reader.
And you also have this sort of tremendous community and a lot of passion and excitement and discussion occurring at nofearcommunity.com. Now, can you describe some of these other leaders that are contributing to this discussion on the book and why they're doing this? And who are these leaders and what lessons are they providing?
Oh, absolutely. Super happy. So when we started to reach out to the people we're working with, our network, we got a lot of additional feedback beyond I'm able to write a section here. We got people that say, yep, I really want to be participating. I want to participate in the discussion on the No Fear community site. And they can do this in a variety of ways. Of course, as I just mentioned earlier, they're contributing in blog format, so writing their thoughts down and then starting a discussion on the site. But also we will see, in the time for launch, we will see video interviews with leaders that we are doing similar to what you're doing here right now with me. We have the opportunity to go out and interview CEOs and business leaders across the world, government leaders across the world that are sharing their thoughts, and we will make them available to the readers of No Fear Business Leadership in the Digital Age on the community site. We have, I think, one of the interviews that just got finished, it's not posted yet, is with the CEO of one of the large manufacturing companies, KONE, the second largest elevator manufacturer is one of them. We have professors from different universities that are stepping up and said, yep, I definitely want to condense my key message and put it in video format and contribute. We have, people from large, I said, device manufacturers and mobile device manufacturers that are signing up, and even people from the analyst community, which are usually trying to be very, very neutral, of course, but they are really seeing the opportunity and the insights that are delivered here in such a unique way that they say, yep, I'm making sure that I'm endorsing this with the people I'm working with. So, for example, Peter Sondergaard from Gartner, one of the top analysts there, got permission from the Gartner management to officially endorse the book and the community as a key source of insight for business leaders. The book itself, we were very fortunate of being able to send a draft of the manuscript out to a couple of people whose opinion we really, really treasure. And because of the very tight timelines, interesting, because this book, usually books take about a year, this one has been fast-tracked by the publishers across the world. We are working in a very, very tight timeline, but people still were saying, yep, I'm happy to contribute based on what I'm reading here. And we got some fantastic endorsements that are really meaning a lot to us. I think, Stephen, you were one of the people that had a chance to look at the manuscript and highly recommend it. So I really, so personally, of course, I'm very thankful for that. Especially because you know the environment, you know what's on CEOs' minds, and being able to count on that experience and that validation means a lot to both Pekka and myself. We have the former CIO of Siemens in China, so Siemens, large, one of the top companies in the world, and largest foreign investors in China. He was running their IT organization for many years beyond Russia. He read and was faced with a lot of the challenges of developing leaders and the technology changes that are happening in those areas, combining them and bringing them to success. So Bjana Russia was willing to read the manuscript, validate again, and said, yep, this is exactly what people should read. He's, by the way, still with Siemens. He's running as a CIO. He's running one of their divisions right now as their CIO, the infrastructure there, the technology there. And also from the academic world, one of the people who is focusing on workplace changes, the new world of work, and driving key insights there across the international community is the Professor Michael Bartz out of Vienna. He has published intensively on the new world of work, and he looked at the manuscript of No Fear and highly endorses it as well. We got another endorsement just from the CEO of Project Line Incorporated, one of the top technical consulting companies here in the Pacific Northwest, serving IT companies working with their leadership on a regular basis, or companies like SAP, T-Mobile, Microsoft, AT&T, and a vast variety of other companies that are on their website, who he is working with, and says, yes, this is exactly what the challenges they are facing. So he is recommending the book to his clients and, of course, to everybody else as well.
You know, you mentioned that you've got, or you're engaging leaders around the world using videos and recording them using video technology. What kinds of ways are you doing that?
It is interesting, the topic of videos has been changed dramatically, I think, over the last years. Partly, and I think the two key influencers are YouTube, and now the next one is coming is mobile technologies, and I'll explain a little bit more in a second. So videos themselves in the past were this high production value clips, or sometimes even longer speeches for multiple minutes, sometimes hours, where a complete presentation or a complete production experience was required. And this has changed. I think this has really changed over the last years a lot through YouTube. People are used to getting shorter snippets of key information in a video format. They are able to know, so that people are now knowing that video is one additional source they can leverage. TED speeches, TED Talks, are another vehicle where thought leaders share their thoughts in 10, 15 minutes often on a video format on the website, so people can actually get these snippets of information in relatively quick format and short time. So what we are making sure that for those leaders, we're using different kinds of approaches. We have a cameraman and to actually do some of the interviews in a more higher production style. But we are also utilize again the YouTube self-made style, where the executive or the direct team is very comfortable with it, because we think it is far more important to get the message out than having a glossy video itself. So we really want to make sure we get the message out as quickly as possible, as efficient as possible. And we are going to also look, going forward, when mobile becomes more important, it is important to understand that the video snippets need to be even shorter. So while the typical YouTube time is about 2 minutes these days. All the research shows that on the mobile world, a video cannot be longer than 10, maximum 15 seconds. So we have to be super precise and super engaging in a very, very short time frame and get the message across.
So are you using things like Skype technology as well? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's Skype was absolutely essential in making this book happen. So No Fear is a fantastic example of an international cross-time zone, cross-culture and functions collaboration. And Skype actually has become, for us and for this project, Skype and shared workspaces in the cloud have become the vehicles for our collaboration. Of course, we've still used email, but we had regular calls. It started with a call between Pekka and myself on Skype, and we basically managed the process as a producer without once getting all of the people in a room. We will all meet in Finland in June for the launch event, but it's for most of us the first time actually meeting in person. All the collaboration has been done through Skype, again, collaborate and share, cloud services, where we were able to share documents and drive collaboration that way, leveraging resources across the globe so we had people working on the actual production team in the Seattle area and the Finnish team in London and Singapore. All of them came together, making sure we're discussing the multiple aspects from marketing to writing to publishing, pulling all of these people together, and Skype has been definitely a very, very valuable tool. With the announcement that just came out that Microsoft is buying Skype for a huge amount of money, I think $8.5 billion, that is definitely a bold move, I would say, but it shows the importance that technology and collaboration technologies have become for a lot of people that are working in the new work style already, and it's becoming more and more important for traditional employees and traditional work environments as well.
Now, can you describe what you discovered in researching and then writing the book?
Sure, absolutely. I think one of the key things was really that independent who we talked to, what was their current role, what was their experiences, or how far their experiences went, it was a hot topic for really everybody. It doesn't matter if you were in HR, if you were in the facilities environment, if you were driving to define marketing strategies. The topics of the generational shift, the shift in work styles and communication culture was top of mind for many, many people. And I think that's one of the reasons why the publisher, of course, fast-tracked the book, while we already have commitment for translations into so many other languages. So that is definitely definitely on top of people's mind. We have the topic of consumerization of IT is something that I had the chance in the research for this book and, of course, in my daily work to focus on quite a bit. And I'm very confident that we will see some interesting changes and challenges in that aspect that will impact far more than we can expect right now. I think there will be topics like access to information, times of work, the devices we will use, but also the kind of work we are doing. I think as email has transformed work in the past, the devices, the mobile devices, the different form factors will change it, and it will have an impact also on things like manageability, access of information in the back end, access of social network, access to network of knowledge, as well as security. I think there's a very clear fundamental shift that is just starting to happen of how people think about some of these core aspects of IT, and how they are going to change and how that change is managed. So I think we are just in the beginning here. We are hitting a very hot topic, but I'm already thinking about based on this project on what is the next topic. What is the next topic I want to spend a little bit more time on, and publish probably my third book on. So we are there's definitely lots to discover more, and there's more. Personally, I'm drilling into it. As more I'm learning, as more I'm talking with people from across the globe, as more excited I am about what's happening. And I think as more we can document and share, and I'd say maybe in 12 months we'll talk about book number 3. Who knows?
Well, it sounds exciting. Now, can you share some lessons from your book that have direct value to the audience?
Yeah, thanks. I think one of them I mentioned earlier is the leader. The role of the leader is really changing. The leader is becoming more a producer of a specific result than what the traditional line manager was expected to do. It is more about understanding the overall direction, communicating the overall direction, and being then able to pull resources together that are complementing each other and being able to deliver that targeted result in the most efficient way. It will be very different who these people are, who these team members are. The criteria will be very different. I think things like internationalization, being able to adapt to other cultures, to be aware of how people with different backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, but also different professional experiences and focus areas are working together. Being able to be globally mobile, both physically mobile, but also intellectually and through communication, collaboration opportunities. So the team compositions and what makes people contributors and leaders successful in the next 10 years will be very, very different than what were key success criteria in the last 20, 30 years. And that's something I hear very frequently now from HR leads as well. They are basically changing the profiles of what kind of people they are looking for. The second one is really authenticity, and we call it the personal brand. So who are you? I don't think with the availability of information now out there, it is nearly impossible to keep up a facade that is completely different than the actual reality, both for individuals as well as for organizations and countries. We're talking about things like WikiLeaks on one side, and sharing of information is just such about like mini Microsoft. If you want to learn something about Microsoft, there are pages about Walmart, SAP, it doesn't really matter, whoever you're interested in. You can nearly find out all kinds of information already, that in the past you probably would not even getting close to. So being authentic, being understanding who you are, and then living up to that experience, being clear in your communication, will be a big expectation for people to be successful in the future, for organizations to be successful in the future. And again, it's important to understand why many of us growing up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, are understanding the concept of privacy, having a very high value for privacy, especially when I grew up in Europe, where that is still a very, very hot discussed topic today. And it's a very important topic to figure out how we want to deal with it and how we talk about it and what are the impacts in our daily lives going forward. But there's a new generation coming into the workspace, growing up with Facebook, Googling all kinds of information about people, and organization when they want to know about it, that have a very different expectation of what privacy actually means. And having multiple identities to maintain, it becomes nearly impossible or definitely very costly. So authentic leaders, authentic organizations will be one of those key criteria for success going forward. The other role for leaders in all levels is the traditional leadership model of either the general on the hill who is just overseeing his troops marching and giving them directions from time to time, or the micromanager who is day-to-day deep into the details of a specific project. Both of those roles by themselves will not be the roles for success. The roles, what will make a leader successful is what we call the helicopter style. So you have to be able to get out of the battlefield to making sure helicoptering up, making sure you're getting the overall overview, you understand which piece goes where, which battalion you need to use, what kind of approach you need to use for the overall battle. But then you will see while you're up there certain areas where your personal involvement is necessary. So you will be able to helicopter down in that specific area, be hands-on, be a helper for that particular team, not taking over the work, but really helping them to get their best done. And then as soon as that team, as that area is on track again, you helicopter out, look at the big picture, and then go in where it's necessary again. So it requires far more flexibility on the leader, both, again, from a different, providing the different perspective, engaging day-to-day, and also being able to sharing information between them, and the people they are leading and the organizations they are leading. As I said earlier, the expectations of transparency, of authenticity, of the new generation are a good example of what leaders are expected. I think the traditional approach of information is power, and I want to hold it close to my vest, those will die out, and they actually will make leaders or managers that are driving that strategy very, very quickly obsolete by their teams. A real leader needs to be contributing value to the team itself. If they are helicoptering down, they better know exactly what they're bringing, they better know how to engage, and they bring value to the team to make that particular team successful. Not distract them, not hold information back, but really give them the resource they need to be successful. From a management perspective. From a company culture perspective, the organizations that are most likely, or they are most an example today for nearly organizations of all industries. Doesn't matter if it's manufacturing, if it's non-profit organizations. The example they should follow is really the traditional professional services firm culture, where you are focusing laser sharp of what your particular client's needs are and making sure you are providing them the resources, tools, information, knowledge they need to address their particular challenges. Again, professional services firms focus on the challenges more in the traditional consulting, of course, would be applied to. But the concept itself is applicable more and more even to any kind of goods. If you produce machines, cars, shirts for that matter, it doesn't really matter. It's the attitude of understanding your client's needs and then delivering tailored what they actually need through the tools you have, to the infrastructure you have, to the network of partners, suppliers, information you have. That is the key approach to success going forward, and it also will determine who you are hiring and who are you promoting. If you are in charge of an organization, you better really like people. You like to engage with them. You like to make them successful. You like to mentor them. Otherwise, it will be very hard for you to be successful in that environment. And last but not least, of course, it's technology. Technology is a key enabler of a lot of the change we are seeing and a key provider for a lot of the opportunities there. Again, I think if you talked earlier about the PlayStation generation, the people born after 85, they grew up with the access to the internet. They grew up in a time where mobile communication was just part of their daily life. For them, it is very hard to imagine that if you have a question, you go to your encyclopedia in your living room and you take it out and you look at something that might have been written 30 years ago or 20 years ago to get an answer to a question. Or you go to the library to figure out an answer to the question. For them, the first inclination, if they have a question, is switching on the computer and looking on the internet and finding the answer there. It's just a very, very different approach that becomes second nature, and it has really shifted how people think about work, life, how the combination is, why they're working, how they're living their life, how they're connecting, what information they are sharing, and that is going to be the key driver while they are coming into the work environment, for the work environment itself, and it will create the opportunity and the challenges for organizations to adapt and support that kind of change and that kind of expectations.
Well, those are tremendous lessons for current and future leaders around the world, and they'll gain a lot of value when they drill into your book about all of these lessons and many, many more. Now, how do you plan to further build the audience for the book, and at what specific events do you have in mind?
So we are having we're really seeing a combination of the old and the new world happening around No Fear. We're not only talking about it, we're actually combining it, and we're seeing it partly driven by us, and partly it's already, if you start with the ecosystem itself and understand the environment, it's actually starting from areas you haven't even expected it. So traditionally, there are a couple of key events we're going to do together with the publisher. I mentioned we will have a launch event in Helsinki on June 8th. So just in case one of your listeners is there, shoot me an email. We'd be happy to see you there, where we will launch the book with a lot of the key contributors out there. Then we will have a second launch event in Moscow, where We have in one of the TV stations, there will be a TV interview. We will have the journalist there, probably Mr. Arkady will be there, the advisor of the Russian president, and who knows who else will make show up there. But that will be a very interesting event for people in the Moscow area. We will have additional events for the launch in New York, in Beijing, and in London. So that is where we have similar environment, where we have press and some of the thought leaders there to engage with them. Then just in mid-June, Pekka has been invited by the Russian president to speak at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum as one of the keynote speakers there to talk about No Fear. Both of us are on the tour relatively regularly, where we are talking about our key topics, including No Fear. I'm focusing in addition, of course, on cloud computing, consumerization of IT, IT agility, business agility, and the new world of work in general. But of course, No Fear is one of the key topics that are definitely requested right now, and that drives a lot of early excitement. We will have a presence, just been informed, at the largest trade show for books in Frankfurt later in the summer. So that will happen. We are working day to day, both Pekka and I, with universities and corporations that are asking us to help them. So we just had one of the large automotive companies ask us to come in and work with their senior leadership team based on a presentation they have seen before. So we were going in with working with them, and that is on impact on their overall organization, both HR as well as IT, and really pulling this together. Personally, I'm absolutely excited to be at the World CIO Forum in November, and looking forward to see as many of our listeners today there. Love to hear from them as well. If there's a specific area, of course, in a presentation you always have limited time. If there's a specific area based on what they see on the website they would like us to focus on, looking very, very much forward. We have, as I said earlier, we have top analysts like Dieter Sondergaard from Gartner who are going out and in their interactions highlighting this as one of the key drivers. We have other publications like Harvard Business Review and management magazines across the world who are picking this up now, interviewing and sharing those interviews. So there's definitely a lot of momentum around this. The social networks, of course, are a key driver. LinkedIn, on the U.S. side, of course, China Value in China are two big players. We love what we are working with, and we really enjoy working in the interactive organization discussions. You'll find us on, of course, Facebook, LinkedIn itself, and last but not least, the online community. I think this is where we really will have the next step before and after the book is coming out. Where we have the opportunity to continue the discussion, to evolve, to stay up to date. We said it's hard to imagine what the world in 5 or 10 years will look like, but I think this is the place where we all together can collaboratively learn about it, share it, and maybe even design it together.
Have you had a chance to talk to Reid Hoffman at all, or some of the other leaders out there in the online community?
We have reached out to a variety of people. I don't think I haven't talked with Reid. I'm trying to remember. If you look at the Twitter followers, there's a variety of people that are retweeting on No Fear book right now, on agility as well. So I think those are definitely interesting contacts, and I'm super happy to have follow-on discussions with them as well. Would be very excited about it.
Now, you've had a chance to do additional research, especially with this book, and engage with some of the top thinkers around the world and leaders around the world. So has that adjusted your predictions for the future? Like, what are your predictions now about what's going to happen?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you're always learning. I think the good news is what I was thinking about a year ago is not completely wrong, so which I'm, as I say, I'm pretty proud about that. But I think it's there are a couple of trends that were visible about a year ago and that becoming more and more clear now, what will impact us over the next at least 5 years, I would say. One is really Moore's Law, and I think Intel just announced with the 3D chips they are sure they will continue on Moore's Law on the chip side. It has been proven correct for the last 40 years, and there's no reason to doubt that it will not be correct for the future. Interesting, though, is really thinking about what does this actually mean, and in practical applications. Of course, we all have heard the stories that our phones today are far more powerful than all the computer environment the NASA used in the late 60s, early 70s to launch people to the moon. But thinking this forward, what does this mean, what the world in 10 years look like? And if you think about the mobile devices, the most powerful mobile devices people have in their hands right now, if Moore's Law holds correct, those devices will be 1,000 times more powerful in only 10 years. So there's a huge, huge movement happening there on computing power itself that will outstrip anything we can probably vaguely imagine at this point in time. Not because we can't imagine the computing power of a big data center in our hand, but what can we actually do with it? Is it? I think when the internet started, the PCs became more powerful. Not a lot of people envisioned video or video conferencing being some of the key drivers. Social networking, all of these things are very, very new inventions that were enabled by having the technology in so many hands and being able to do that. So just imagining that these little devices become so far more powerful in such a relatively short time frame, it is, I would say, 100% sure that it will create very, very different ways of communicating and working. What those ways are, I wish I would know them exactly today, and I would probably build those businesses right now. There's a couple of interesting startups in that area, but there's definitely a lot still to do. The wireless access to information and to people, the access to information, to knowledge, to the network, the personal network, the professional network, will become absolutely essential. It will continue to expand. It's everywhere in the world. Nearly everywhere in the world, we will have access to information. So the necessity to actually store a lot of information on a specific device will become less and less relevant. We have today over 5 billion people that are theoretically, that could have a mobile technology today that are covered in areas. The big challenge we see on the mobile side is actually bandwidth. That it's not the device themselves, it's not the applications, but the actual data bandwidth. It's interesting that today on a remote island in Indonesia, you can have better connection on your smartphone or iPad compared to downtown Manhattan. So there is definitely a big challenge for the communication providers that they will have to face as more and more of people have the expectation that all the time they have access to whatever they need and wherever it's stored from whatever device. So there will definitely be an interesting challenge there happening over the next, I would say, 5 years. The internet itself is transforming. I think from the repository of data and the email transport vehicle, it really has become a connection infrastructure for people and knowledge. It's not replacing personal relationships. I think I had a chance to talk with Sally Tucker about her book a few months ago, where we are looking at about how our personal relationships are transformed. And I think, personally, I think it will actually enrich us. It will not replace the personal interaction, the conversation at a fireplace, eye to eye, but it will enable far more of us to stay in touch with far more of the people we in the past would have lost touch with. It provides us the opportunity to be in different geographical places and still have meaningful conversation. We have seen, I think, the studies a few years ago, and it was not for the Digitalist Cowboys, they were actually growing up with it. That was a study for people that had to learn mobile technology or collaboration technologies enabled by the internet. We found that if people meet every 6 months and do the rest of the work virtually, there's no difference between people that actually, from a productivity perspective and all the other criteria on team performance, that compared to people that are actually in the same locations, but they still needed to meet every 6 months. It would be interesting to see that do the study again with just people from the latest generation that are growing up only on primarily on mobile, internet-based collaboration technologies, and see if those physical meetings are truly necessary or at what frequency they actually are necessary. So that's, I think, those are definitely key trends there. The Fourth one I mentioned earlier is the consumerization of IT. We have seen it actually, a small inclination of that in the 90s with email. By providing free email access and the chat opportunities like with AOL Messenger, ICQ, it first took hold actually in a lot of private households. Students used it, private households used it, and then it became more and more a vehicle of companies as well of companies as well. And I think we see that very clearly today, and we will see this even more while consumer technology, just because it is so easy to address a relatively large market with new technology and recoup the investments, demonstrate their value for the individual very quickly. And as soon as the individual understands the value, there's no way they would give up that particular improvement on productivity, access to information and knowledge if they are entering the workplace. So if somebody is very successful, very quick, very responsive in their private life, they want to be able to deliver that same experience to their network at work, both inside the organization and outside the organization. So we will see a big push for the IT organizations either to recreate a similar experience or to embrace the consumer technologies that are already out there for business processes. And I think that's probably not the right answer, one or the other. There will be probably likely a lot of hybrid solutions. But as consumer technology goes, it is very often not designed for the corporate environment. Things like manageability, security, access rights, all of these things are not necessarily thought through on primarily consumer devices and experiences. So understanding those impacts and finding the right way, whatever the right way for a specific organization and specific information is likely one of the big challenges organizations and especially IT organizations and compliance teams have to think about. Personally, I think it will impact security and our understanding of security in a fundamental way, which I compare in the book. The No Fear book, with what you have seen in Europe in the Middle Ages. I think our traditional approach is to keep as much of our corporate information secret and protected, like in the Middle Ages, city built high walls around them. And when the walls were not high enough and thick enough, they built higher and thicker walls. And I think that's what I'm seeing right now across the globe, how IT is thinking about security. Let's make the walls higher, let's make them bigger and keep them more secure. Which will continue to be successful and possible and affordable for a while longer. Not sure how long, but for a while longer. But the head of the MI5, the British Secret Service IT organization, about 10 years ago, actually, he said, you have to really think about information as business assets and how important to your business they are. And that methodology actually drives over now in a lot of the business conversations as well, to think about what is really business critical. What are the business critical information? Maybe the Coca-Cola recipe? Okay. Absolutely. Nuclear launch codes? Yes. But is Windows source code really that secret anymore? Well, most of it has already leaked on the internet. So do I really need to take all these efforts and keep it secret? Going back to the middle-aged cities, what happened is when the technology moved forward and cannons and artillery basically made the walls, made it not possible to build higher walls. The downsides of having the cities constrained versus the upside of very limited protection basically led to most cities tearing down the walls. They are now all ring roads in the European cities, and the cities expanded, trade expanded, information flow expanded, and the assets that really needed to be kept secret or kept protected were put into banks, into vaults, hidden in a different way. So there will be definitely security will stay and will be super important going forward, but I think we will have a different understanding of what needs to be secure and how secure does it need to be and how much security can I as a company, as an organization, actually afford in a time when the amount of information and the access and searchability and findability of information is increasing tremendously. So of course, we'll have an impact on the compliance team. So there's a lot of open questions that still have to be discussed. Last but not least is the networking effect. We have seen this with email. We have seen it with telephony in the past. We've seen it with the social networks now. As more people adopt a technology, as more, or a specific environment, as more valuable, that overall environment and the technology will become for the individual himself, him or herself. So if only you and I have a phone, well, that's kind of nice because we can still talk. But if nearly everybody has a phone number and we can reach them, makes the phone itself a far more powerful and far more impactful tool for you and me, but also for everybody else. And the cost will go down dramatically as well. So I think setting up a line between Seattle and Canada would be nearly cost prohibitive for both of us. But being able to participating in a global network, the costs themselves are nearly negligible, and the benefit is tremendous. And that's the same with the social networks we have seen growing over the last few years. I think I can remember my first Facebook account just because we were thinking about invest at Microsoft. We were thinking about investing into the company that had just started, so I was open up an account, tried it out, see how it all worked, and about only a year later, millions and millions and millions of more users have joined, and now I would say even my mother has an account. So it's really completely spread across the world, the value that particular tool has. Similar with LinkedIn, I think that's a very good example where we can see it was from updating resumes, and I think in the recession we saw even more push there where people start to stay in touch, to really becoming an opportunity to stay in touch with people you have worked in the past, to reaching out to people you might haven't talked for 10, 15 years, but you know based on your interaction then, there might be opportunities for sharing knowledge, driving projects together, and now you can actually do that. You can reach out to them, you can ask them for their opinion, for their feedback, and it goes now into the next level, which I think is very interesting, where instead of having your own original, where you take the external network onto the offline network onto the online world, you actually create new networks in the online world. LinkedIn's communities and discussion groups are a good example, where you can self-organize by topics you're interested in. If it's strategic technology leadership where I'm participating, or VPs of marketing and sales, SAP, Oracle groups, Microsoft groups, all of these things are self-organized, and you have the opportunity to post questions, get responses from people that are interested either in the same question or, of course, they already have the answer. Accessing a vast area of knowledge in an organized way that helps you to be far more productive and far more efficient going forward. I think one of my favorite discussions lately was on several LinkedIn groups, actually, a discussion of how to use the iPad for business purposes. Interesting, both on a discussion group for cloud computing as well as on a discussion group for sales and marketing people. The similar question was raised, and the answers were, a lot of them were similar, some of them were vastly different, but it actually helped me to making sure I discover some more applications for my iPad that I hadn't noticed before, and see how they can change my environment. So the access to that information, sharing of that information, definitely has a huge impact there.
Those are tremendous series of predictions, and we'll be following them closely. Now, in your travels, in your interactions with large communities out there, you must get some really interesting questions. And so can you maybe share some of them, and what are your answers to those questions?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the discussions with the people thinking about similar challenges, have read the books, or are faced with challenges I'm thinking about as well, of course, are really, really interesting and really invigorating day-to-day life, figuring out solutions together to their business problems, to our challenges. So I think that is definitely one of the best parts of my life, my job, my interactions. Especially around No Fear, when we talk about the concept of the book No Fear, say we are focusing on the young generation that is a majority in a lot of the emerging markets, a question I get relatively consistently from leaders out of the traditional Western world is, well, I understand that it is important for the developing world or for the emerging markets, but is that really relevant for me in the Western world? Do I have to change? Do I have to be more authentic? Do I have to share more information? Do I really have to embrace all these technologies on a 24/7 base. How do I deal, or can I just say, you know what, I'm waiting a little bit longer, and we are having overaging in those areas anyway, so it doesn't really, it's that important to me. I think that is one of the key questions I'm hearing frequently. And the answer is, usually it depends. But if you are in a Western country, you're running a traditional company, and you're not planning to grow, you're not planning to expand, you're not planning to be, or you don't see any competition happening for the next 3 to 5 years from somewhere abroad, you're probably okay just going the way you are. But if you want to move, if you want to compete in the international environment, if you want to compete in the international environment, not only from a sales perspective, but also from a talent recruiting perspective, if you want to be able to leverage the resources that are out there at different prices, globalization is a keyword definitely overused, but I think it provides in a very broad sense of globalization is access to resources and knowledge across the globe, a huge opportunity organizations can tap into if they are willing to embrace it, if they're willing to share, if they're willing to contribute to the communities they are part of, the employees they have on their teams, the new leaders they are developing. It provides huge, huge opportunities. And we find that when companies, teams, and individuals engage and embark on that journey, and they find the rewards very quickly, very, very rewarding.
Well, it's interesting that, you get sort of this divergent kind of questions, whether it's, with regards to sort of developed nations or developing nations and their perspective of what's required. So it's interesting that you get this sort of difference in viewpoints.
Yeah, and I mean, we have seen this in my first book, Agility. To compete and to win, technology plays definitely a key role, has played over the last 5-10 years, and will play a far more important role over the next years as well. So you can really see predict the success of an organization based on their technology capabilities versus the market versus their competition. You can predict their success over 5-10 years relatively consistently. So I would, as an investor, I would ask companies to actually make that public, but that's not that easy, I would assume. I think it's for internal benchmarking, for internal planning, it's a huge, huge opportunity. And we see it across the globe, that the trends are definitely there, that the proof is actually there, that technology matters. The emerging markets are more embracing it, or they have to embrace it more because they don't have a choice. If they want to hire new people, they are usually younger than in the older world, or in the Western world, and they bring a different attitude, different understanding, and different tools to the workplace. So companies need to embrace it. I think it's sometimes we're so getting our own perspective, our own viewpoint limits what is happening outside. And living in the U.S. for a long time, it's interesting to hear from marketing people in London or business leader in China to see how the world there is changing and how fast it is changing. The U.S. itself has never been a leader in mobile technology. I mean, the iPhone, yep, definitely made big impact, but I think compared to their attitude and aptitude to technology and mobile communication in countries like Japan, China, even in a lot of European countries, Scandinavian countries, European countries in general, there's still lots we can see over there that then would actually influence our prediction for what's happening here. So how many mobile devices does somebody actually need and usually have? How do they communicate? How often do they upgrade? I think I mentioned earlier that devices become so quickly so more powerful. One of the statistics that really stuck with me is that typical early 20s person in Thailand today, buys a new cell phone every 6 months just because the old one is outdated and doesn't do anymore what they need to do. And then you compare that with tech refresh cycles for most of the providers of 2 years in some other countries, and you see that that is very likely not the path to future success and to addressing the needs of the digital cowboys, independent of their age.
Well, Mark, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today and for you to share so many insights in all of your research and excerpts from your book in terms of lessons learned and your dealings and collaborations with some of the top thinkers around the world. Again, we really thank you, you know, for coming in today to do this interview, and with especially with your extensive history of successes, and I know your schedule is very tight, so again, it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Stephen, the pleasure is absolutely on my side, being able to share those thoughts with you, discussing those questions with you, and the audience that is going to listen to you on a regular basis and us, you know, here on a regular basis is really gratifying. It's really a pleasure to do that. I can say I'm looking very much forward to the continued feedback from the participants of the communities, both of course on agility, competing and winning in a tech-savvy marketplace, as well as on the new upcoming book, No Fear. Business of business leadership in the age of digital cowboys, and the No Fear community. So this is, by the way, again, it's www.nofear-community.com. I'm looking very, very much forward to getting feedback and discussions going there as well with the listeners today. I'm very excited to be here today and looking forward to the summit in China in November. Really looking forward.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Mark Mueller-Eberstein, best-selling author, and he has a new book, No Fear, Business Leadership in the Age of Digital Cowboys. Mark is also a globally top-ranking CEO, COO, speaker, mentor, coach, and strategist.